from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is a tin roof project on Tales from the South.
It was 22 feet tall and beautifully shaped with full regular branches from top to bottom. It had that great blue-silver color that you want in these trees. As soon as we saw the tree, I just had a feeling that things were not going to go right and we were going to have problems.
Recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas.
Well, now we have a problem. I had 24 hours to figure out how to put a 72-inch tree through a 40-inch door.
This week, it's an intimate dinner with a notable Southerner on our unrehearsed show, telling their story as if they were sitting on the porch with you.
The house is 200 years old and not designed for this type of situation. After consulting with the usher's office and the Park Service architect, I came up with an idea I hoped would work.
So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
I can't help it if I'm still in love with you. Another memory of the girl and the things we used to do. Just another day in the life of a fool. Singing another sad country song. A song about a heartache and a love that's gone wrong. This sad state of mind has caused me to start thinking this honky-tonk living is gonna drive me to drinking. Oh, this honky-tonk living is gonna drive me to drinking.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for listening to us tonight. Have fun.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a very special edition of Tales from the South, a series we call the Tin Roof Project, where well-known Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Originally from Washington, D.C., former White House executive gardener Mike Lawn joined the National Park Service July 1977 and was promoted to gardener foreman of the White House in December 1980, where he served for 28 years under five administrations: Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush. Mike Lawn oversaw all aspects of the gardens and grounds, from Easter egg rolls and ceremonies honoring fellow citizens to treaty signings and receptions for heads of state. Mike managed the daily operations of the spectacular 18-acre ensemble of formal gardens, secluded natural retreats, and expansive parkland surrounding the White House, which have been shaped by America's presidents and first ladies, some of the nation's best-known landscape designers and architects, and generations of dedicated gardeners and horticulturists. Mike Lawn retired January 2008 after 31 years in the National Park Service. He currently lives in Silver Spring, Maryland, and is planning on moving with his family to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania in the fall. Tonight, Mike Lawn shows us what can happen when you have an 11-foot-wide spruce, some irreplaceable antique glass, and a saw in The Tree from Hell. Ladies and gentlemen, Mike Lawn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Mike Lawn, and yes, it's spelled just like the grass. I'm here today to talk to you about my job and give you a little bit of an insight into it. As most of you know, I worked at the White House for many years, actually 28. I could tell you any number of stories about these years, like the time one of my daughters and I visited the Oval Office and how she sat behind the president's desk and proceeded to try and use the phones. This is not a good idea. Or the time my family had a private tour of the second floor, which is the president's private residence, which includes the Lincoln and the Queen's bedroom. The Queen's bedroom is named that because five queens have slept there. And one of my daughters wanted to use the bathroom to see how a queen feels like sitting on the other throne. And then there was a time early in the morning when I was working on my daily schedule in my office, and I heard all this noise and banging on the other side of my office wall. I yelled out, "What in the hell is going on out there?" And thinking it was one of my crew. Much to my chagrin, as I walked outside, I was met by a Secret Service agent and the president. They explained that they'd been looking for something and were sorry to disturb me. Of course, I was mortified, but all was well, and in the end, we had a pretty good laugh over it. I could go on and on with these and other anecdotes, but I think I would like to concentrate on one incident and tell the whole story from the beginning to the end. It involves hope, desperation, and old-fashioned ingenuity. I'm going to have to call this the Christmas tree from hell. As soon as we saw the tree, I just had a feeling that things were not going to go right and we were going to have problems. It was 2 months before Christmas, and the White House superintendent of grounds, the head usher of the White House, and myself, the White House grounds foreman, were in Pennsylvania picking out the official White House Christmas tree for the Clinton administration. We were standing in front of a beautiful blue spruce. It was 22 feet tall and beautifully shaped with full regular branches from top to bottom. It had that great blue-silver color that you want in these trees. The only drawback was that it was 11 feet wide. One of the challenging duties I had as a gardener foreman was the annual Christmas decorating. The First Lady, along with the head florist, come up with the idea and the annual theme, and my crew and I execute many key parts of this event, including selecting the official White House Christmas tree. This tree is not the one you see the president light on the TV to kick off the season in early December. That one is a live tree planted on the ellipse on the south of the White House, and it is the national tree. The White House tree is a cut tree that is placed in the blue room of the White House. This is where the president and the first lady welcome Christmas visitors and guests to the social events of the season. This tree is the center point of the decorations at the White House, and the tree itself is donated each year by a member of the National Christmas Tree Growers Association. This member is given the honor by a means of an annual contest to determine the best tree. The selection process was performed by three people from the White House, and the tree could come from anywhere in the United States. We've had trees from Oregon to North Carolina and anywhere in between. We would go see the prospective tree to inspect it and make sure that it met all the requirements. It had to be at least 20 feet tall, have uniform branching from the top to the bottom, be the right color, and have the ability to hold whatever ornaments were to be used. So there we were in Pennsylvania in front of a tree we thought was perfect, except that it was 11 feet wide. In order to get the tree into the White House, it has to enter the front door. Well, the front door of the White House is 40 inches wide. And then once inside the White House, it has to go through the blue room door, which is 39 inches wide. So any tree going through these doors has to be compressed to these widths. Normally, with a more supple tree, it can be drawn through a baler, which compresses the branches and wraps the tree tightly together. It is pulled butt first, and then the branches flatten onto each other. But the bottom branches of this tree were 3 inches thick and quite stiff and long. I had my doubts that it would fit. The grower assured me that it would not be a problem because he had done this many times before. We left there hoping for the best. 2 months later, we went back to pick up this tree and several others that would be used in other rooms at the White House. When we arrived, I noticed a grouping of nicely baled trees. When asked where the blue room tree was, I was met with silence. Apparently, this tree was going to be a problem, as I thought at the beginning. It would not go through the baler and indeed had broken the baler trying. When I asked the grower what we could do, he told me to take the other baled trees and he would hand tie up the blue room tree and make it fit. He would deliver it to me himself the next day. Well, the timing of the decoration process is very critical. It takes 4 full days to complete, and it all starts with the trees. They must be in place so that the electricians can light them, and then the flower shop can decorate them. The blue room tree is usually scheduled for the second day of this process. In the morning that we started, I received a phone call from the grower. He said that he would arrive at 10 a.m. He got there on time and came in a large box truck with the tree inside. And as soon as he opened the door, my heart sank. The tree inside was indeed tied up, but could not be compressed to less than 72 inches. A full 32 inches wider than the doors. The grower explained that the bottom branches started breaking when he started to tie them. Well, now we have a problem. I had 24 hours to figure out how to put a 72-inch tree through a 40-inch door. After pulling out what little hair I had left, I started to think of other ways to get it in. There are no other wider doors and no service bay openings. The house is 200 years old and not designed for this type of situation. After consulting with the usher's office and the Park Service architect, I came up with an idea I hoped would work. Now, the blue room is situated on the second floor of the White House in the back, and it has a 20-foot wide balcony in front of it. The blue room actually has 3 curved windows in it, and these windows are 12 feet high and 60 inches wide. I hope that if we cut off the lowest branches of the tree and remove the window, we might have a chance. The delicacy of this plan rested on removing the window and replacing it without breaking any of the 200-year-old handmade glass panes. They were curved, handmade, and nearly impossible to replace. The next morning, the window was carefully and successfully removed by the carpenters and stored. A 40-ton crane was brought in to lift the tree. It had to be lifted and swung over the balcony and through the window sash opening. When the crane lifted the tree, I prayed it would not break in half. It had to be lifted in a flat position so that we could squeeze it through the window if it would fit. We had to remove about 2 vertical feet of the lower branches, and now the tree was roughly 62 inches wide, but still too big, but we hoped we could pull it through the opening. After tying a rope to guide it, we had 6 men in the room to pull it through as the crane let out the cable. It was now or never, and never was not an option. Miraculously, the tree went in with a few green scrape marks on the sash, which were scrubbed and painted. Now the only problem was that the tree had no lower branches for 3 feet. Fortunately, we had saved what we had cut off, and after drilling holes in the trunk, we reinserted the branches and wired them up to the branches above to stabilize them. The crane was removed, and the window, thank goodness, was reinstalled without breaking. I think more people were worried about the window than they were about the tree. The tree was standing in the center of the room that looked like it had never been pruned. Hallelujah. And the bottom branches stayed green for the next 3 weeks until it was removed. Throughout the Christmas season, we heard several people ask how this huge tree got into the room. And the answer was always the same: very carefully and with lots of luck. The next 18 Christmas seasons were relatively uneventful, and that was a good thing, because I don't think I could have pushed my patience or my luck any further. And though it had been quite an ordeal, that 11-foot-wide blue spruce from Pennsylvania ended up being the biggest and most magnificent tree I ever squeezed into the blue room, and that was just fine with me.
All right, well, thank you so much, Mike Long, for being on our Tin Roof Project on Tales from the South.
Thank you. Thank you.
So you say in your story that the next 18 Christmas seasons were relatively uneventful. So what about the other times of year? Do you have other stories about that required ingenuity and quick thinking on your feet?
Well, there are a few, you know, that come to mind. I remember one time during the first Bush administration, it was in the afternoon, 3 o'clock, there was a motorcade going out. And when a motorcade is set up on the South Lawn, there's about 25 or 30 vehicles out there. Of course, the president's vehicle is like the 3rd or 4th one in the line. And it's usually sitting there waiting for him to walk out of the Oval Office. Well, it's time to the minute. And at 3:03, the president was to come out of his office and get in his limousine. So everybody started up their vehicles. The police started going, and they went to start up. The president got in his limo, and they went to in his limousine. They went to start it up, and the battery was dead. So here we are with 35 cars, the press, the police, the Secret Service, and the president, and no way to get the vehicle running. So quickly, we ran down the hill, got a tractor, a big John Deere tractor, two sets of jumper cables, and jumps the president's limousine so he could get on to a meeting. Yes. And then he left, and certainly there was another limousine waiting where he was going to bring him back. But we did get him out of there rather quickly. Once again, during the Bush administration, we had every afternoon around 12:30 when we were eating our lunch, we would play horseshoes because, of course, the president was very big into horseshoes. So the guys on the grounds crew started our own horseshoe league, and we were playing, and it was a state visit from Boris Yeltsin from Russia. And sure enough, at 12:15, the president brought Boris Yeltsin down to play horseshoes with the Park Service crew. And he had never seen a horseshoe, didn't know what he was doing or anything like that. So the president, through an interpreter, was trying to explain to him how to do it. And then he looked at me and he said, "Mike, I'm sure you can show him how to do this." So my idea was, you know, let's get the interpreter over here. Let's all three of us get horseshoes. Let's throw them all at the same time. Mine went forward, the interpreter's went sideways, and Yeltsin's went backwards. He didn't know how to let go of the shoe, where it was going, or anything. But after about 10 minutes, we got it, you know, got it down to where he got the rhythm, and he threw a shoe, and it hit the post, and it wasn't a ringer, but it made a noise, so he was very happy. And that was the end of our horseshoe days with Boris Yeltsin.
This story happened during the Clinton administration. Of course, Clinton is one of us, right? Yeah, from here from Arkansas. So are there other stories of the Clinton years?
Well, there's several. I mean, you think every day of what you're doing that day. I can remember one day when the president had hurt his knee. He had fallen and had his torn the ACL or something in his knee down at Greg Norman's house in Florida. And, of course, he was back at the White House learning, you know, how to rehabilitate it and things like that. And the First Lady, he had asked us to put she wanted to put a hot tub in for him behind the Oval Office at the private patio. So we said, "Sure, we can do that for you." Of course, we didn't tell the president. She said, "Don't tell the president." I said, "Okay." So we started out. We had to take a small tree down, and then we had to take some shrubs out, and then we had to level out the ground, and then we had to pour cement, and then we had to get a crane in to put the hot tub in. Finally, the president came out one day, and he says, "You know, I've been watching you guys for a week," and he says, "I have no idea what you are doing out here." And, you know, the number one rule at the White House is you never lie to the president. So I said, "Well, Mr. President, we're putting in a hot tub." And he said, "What for?" And I said, "Well, I think it's a birthday surprise for you." And he says, "Well, I bet you Hillary put you up to this, didn't you?" "Didn't she?" And I said, "Well, she had something to do with it." So that was the end of that one. So we did get the hot tub in. The president used it, and he was very grateful.
Was it President Clinton that did Rock the Vote?
Yes. When we had a big concert there on the South Ground, it was a Rock the Vote concert. And when he brought in a bunch of entertainers, mostly that for young adults. And I was sitting in the green room, which was the green tent, so to speak, and I was helping with moving plants around on the stage and doing intermissions. I was back there, and I was sitting back there, and all of a sudden I looked to my left and right, and I had Sheryl Crow, Lenny Kravitz, B.B. King, and Eric Clapton all sitting on the couch with me at the same time. And I'm thinking, what is Mike Lawn doing in here with these three? If anybody knew that he was in here, they'd quick come and get him and drag him out. And then I spent a couple days with Garth Brooks on the South Grounds, walking around. He was very interested in the history of the grounds, what had gone on there, what presidents had done what were some of the historic things that happened there. And every time he had a break, he wanted to take a little walk around the ground. So we did that. And that was a lot of fun working with him also.
Isn't there a story about President Clinton and a golf course?
Oh, yes. Well, President Clinton was an avid golfer, if not a great golfer. He was avid. Robert Trent Jones Jr., or the second, had gone to Russia when Perestroika broke out. And they were building golf courses in Russia, probably one of the first two that were built. They were built by Robert Trent Jones. And when he came back, the president wanted to meet with him, and the Secret Service and the State Department wanted to debrief him to see what was going on over there. But when we were there, he said to the president, "Don't you have a golf green here?" Well, there had been one built there during the Eisenhower administration, but it had been removed during the Nixon administration. Well, he said, "Well, I'll put you one in there." And President Clinton said, "Great, I'd love to have a golf green in there." So he said, I'll send my crew, my staff, my equipment, everything down, and we'll be here Monday morning. We'll build you a golf green. I said, okay. Well, the next Monday, I'm going down at the gate at 6:30 in the morning, waiting for the people to show up, and there's a guy out there named Doug. And I said, Doug? He said, yes, I'm from Mr. Jones's group. And I said, well, where's the rest of your people? He said, I'm it. I said, you're it? I said, I thought we were getting everybody down here. He says, nope, I'm all you're getting. He says, but I'm a designer, so we won't have any problems. I said, well, what are we doing for equipment? He said, well, you must have equipment around here. So we had to find all the equipment we needed, from bulldozers to electricians to irrigation specialists, you name it. Building a golf green is something like building a skyscraper. You start way down in the ground and you work your way up. So when you hit the ground level, you probably come up 3 feet. None of us had ever built a golf green before, so this is a new experience for most of us. And we're working on it, doing as best we can. And after 4 days, Doug looks over and he says, you know, I've really got to get this job finished. He says, I've got some other projects I got to move on to, and my boss is probably wondering what I'm doing. I said, your boss? I said, look over there. I said, my boss is staring out that window for the last 5 days wondering why this job isn't complete. I said, he wants his job done too, so let's try and work together and get it done. So 2 days later, we had it complete, and the president was very, very happy. And then later that year, they had the Ryder Cup team came in, and they used a golf green to practice with and stuff before. They always have a dinner at the White House the night before they go over to, if they go overseas. And certainly President Bush, is one of his good friends was Ben Crenshaw. And whenever Ben Crenshaw played on a senior tournament in the D.C. area, which are a few, he would always stay at the White House and use the green to practice on. Of course, then we had to go out to wherever the tournament was and try to make the green the same speed as the tournament greens, which is not an easy thing to do. But we tried and did our best.
So I think all of us remember where we were on 9/11. As a staff member at that time, where were you? What's your experience of that day?
Well, that morning was actually the day of the congressional picnic. The congressional picnic is held on the South Lawn of the White House every year, usually in the fall, and all the members of Congress, the Senate, and the Supreme Court are invited to the White House with their families for a picnic on the South Lawn. 600 or 700 picnic tables are put out there. All the food is prepared, and it's a giant party that lasts about 6 or 7 hours. Well, we were setting that all up. Actually, the president's mother and father had just left that morning. They had spent the night before there. They had just left about 8 o'clock in the morning to go. I'm not sure where they went, but they had left. When you're working out on the grounds, you don't really know what's going on anyplace else because you don't have a radio, you don't have a TV, you're just working. And so we had no idea what was going on in New York at the time until about, I guess it was about 9:30 or 10 o'clock in the morning, when we heard a loud explosion, and you looked to the southwest and you saw a big cloud of black smoke, and that was the plane hitting the Pentagon. And about that time, of course, everybody's like, well, gee, wonder what happened. And we didn't know then what had happened until one of the ushers came out of the house and said, everybody get off the grounds, and Washington is under attack. So there was about 200 people on the grounds at the time working, and everybody ran for the exits. But there was 4 of us that stayed behind. One was myself, one was the head usher, one was the guy in charge of the event, and one other guy was an electrician. And we knew that if we left the White House, we would never get back in. They would close the gates, and that would be it. And we also knew that if this was something that was, as they said it was, somebody had to remain there to do something if something happened. Certainly the Secret Service was there, but if the fire department came in or something like that, somebody had to know where the different things were, to tell them where to connect, how to get through the gates, where to go. So we stayed, and for the next 45 minutes or so, we were looking for the plane that was still in the sky. Of course, it never came, and it landed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Well, the 4 of us were standing on one of the Jefferson Mounds trying to decide where we would go if we saw the plane coming. On the south grounds of the White House, there's a big fountain. So we all assumed we would run down and jump in the fountain. And after the plane, if it crashed into the White House and burst into flames and stuff like that, we would get up out of the fountain and we would be saved and we would help, do whatever needed to be done to work with the people that would be coming in. Fortunately, that did not happen. But then again, we knew the president would be coming back that night. So we had 600 to 700 picnic tables out on the south lawn. We knew the helicopter would be coming back in. We didn't know when, but we assumed it would be in a matter of hours. So the four of us started moving picnic tables. Well, these picnic tables weigh about 200 pounds apiece. So the four of us, on one on each end, or all four corners, start picking them up and moving them out of the center lawn so that we could get the president in there. And we did that for about 3 hours until about 3 o'clock that afternoon, when they had assumed, or rightly knew, that the Shanksville plane had gone down, all other planes were grounded, and that the president could return, and they opened the grounds back up. And the staff that was still outside came in, removed all the rest of the picnic tables and stacked them up. So if you ever see a documentary of 9/11 and you see the president's chopper land on the south lawn, you'll see the picnic tables all stacked up around behind where the chopper was. And we stayed until we set up the Oval Office for the president to make his speech, and then left that night. And I can just remember driving home at night and wondering, why do these people want to kill me? What have I ever done to them? And then for 3 or 4 days, or maybe even longer after that, anytime I saw an airplane flying overhead, I always thought, well, I wonder if this is another one. But yeah, it was until I got home that night, I did not know what happened in New York. I did not know what happened in Shanksville. I did not know what happened at the Pentagon. Because I came home, my wife was there and my kids, and they were all like, didn't you see this? Didn't you know? It was 6 o'clock. Well, no, it's probably more like 8:30 when I got home, when I first saw what happened.
All right. Well, we have a few minutes left for audience questions. So just raise your hand if you have a question.
What would you say is the oldest plant on the lawns?
Well, the oldest plant on the lawns are the Jackson Magnolias. They were planted in 1832, and they were brought to the White House by Andrew Jackson from the Hermitage in Tennessee. They were his wife Rachel's favorite plants, favorite trees. He brought them there to commemorate her, because back then the inaugurations were certainly, you were elected in November, but the inaugurations were not till the end of March. Now today they're in January. But she died after he was elected, prior to his inauguration. So he brought the magnolias to the South grounds to plant in her name, and the trees are still there. If you look at the back of the $20 bill, you'll see the magnolias on the $20 bill.
When you were forcing the tree through the window, was Hillary involved at all in that?
No. Fortunately, they were not there. I mean, I think if they were, Hillary probably would have been very good about it. She probably would have said, I think we can make this work, you know, let's watch this and go. But however, if the president had been there, he'd have been frantic. I mean, he was so enamored with the history of the White House and things like that. I don't think he would have ever let us take the window out of the house. But no, we had never had any problems with the First Lady or the president as far as that is concerned.
All right, so how about our story and storyteller tonight?
Thank you. Thank you.
So thank you so much, Mike Lawn, for being on our Tin Roof Project on Tales from the South.
Thank you.
Thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication, at aymag.com. Tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library. Additional support provided by the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website, more at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.